sometimes makes me feel a little guilty, like I'm betraying her memory. He waved a defensive hand. I know that sounds stupid, but not so much, Suri replied. No? You remind me of someone, too.
Who?
Suri smiled. My sister. Wraith looked at her. He was puzzled for a moment. Then a smile came to his face, and he chuckled and nodded.
Must be the fur.
He reached up and ran a hand through his hair. So, what do we do now? How about another game of stones? We could get rocks and juggle. You didn't do so well last time. You could use the practice. Oh, and I've got my string. We could just bask on the ground over there, and I could show you how to do a four-handed...
Suri had been pointing at a flat place on the plain, one of the few areas where there was grass. While she was thinking about how soft it would be to sit on, a blast of despair hit her.
Suri? Wraith said.
Rocks, she said.
Rocks?
Piles of rocks.
I don't see any, Wraith told her.
Sadness here. Terrible sadness and incredible loss.
That's Dereya.
Suri felt the sorrow welling up until she thought she might drown. That suffocating feeling rushed back, smothering her.
Suri! Wraith shouted as she collapsed to her knees and began sobbing. There's so much anguish here, she cried.
Wraith lifted her up and began carrying her back toward the bridge.
I think you've had enough fresh air for one day.
No, no, Suri said. I don't want to go back yet.
She squirmed, and he let her down. Suri wiped her eyes and took a breath.
You okay?
Better.
Suri took a few calculated breaths, then started walking back toward the bridge. She felt a powerful need to get farther away from that grassy place.
What happened?
She shook her head.
Felt something awful.
This is an art thing, isn't it?
She nodded, but wasn't entirely sure. Suri really didn't know what had happened. It felt a bit like the sensation of cold she and Arion had experienced in the city, but this sensation had been far more powerful and personal. It had felt so strong that she was surprised.
You didn't feel it? She asked.
Feel what?
Never mind. Maybe it was just my imagination.
You need to recognize that your imagination is more accurate than other people's sight.
Suri didn't like that idea. Not in this case. She wanted it to be a mistake, felt it had to be, but not so much that she'd turn around and test the idea. Suri was happy to leave the question unanswered, because, just as with the sensation with Arion in the city, Suri had the impression she wasn't sensing some awful event from the past. Whatever horrible thing Suri sensed had yet to happen. Feeling a need to hide from the terrible in a bath of ordinary mindlessness, she veered off course toward the Onesa tree.
Maybe we should just sit over here for a bit.
Sure, he said.
Then she saw him glance back across the plain, and he asked, Suri, can you really... He hesitated.
What?
Can you really move mountains?
She frowned.
Yeah, but it was sort of an accident.
Sort of an accident?
I was upset at the time.
Wraith stopped abruptly.
You're upset right now.
He put his arms up, feigning fear.
Should I be worried?
Suri smiled and moved her hands, as if she were going to hex him.
Very.
Ooh,
he said, grinning.
Going to turn me into a frog?
Nope. She walked toward the stump.
Frogs are no fun. What would you like to be?
I don't know. Something that can fly, I guess.
She nodded.
Me too.
Nephron entered the High Hold, a large living space on the seventh floor of the Kype that most of the Instaria called the Shrine. A suite of rooms, decorated with tapestries, sculptures, mahogany chairs, and gold-rimmed chamber pots, was originally built as the living quarters for the Lord of the Wrist. In reality, the seventh floor had only had one resident, and he'd used it for just a short time. Although nothing official had ever been declared, the quarters, although meticulously cleaned and maintained, had been left empty and unaltered since Fain Wrist died. That had been a few thousand years ago, before Nephron was born. Legend held that not a thing had changed. A golden cup, famously rested precariously on the stone moulding near the grand open hearth, and it was believed that Wrist had placed his drink there just before rushing out to his death, his last act in that room. Nephron had come in and looked at that cup many times, wondering what foolish little thing might be his last act that future generations of people would look back on with misplaced worship. He hoped it would be something grander than setting down a cup of wine.
So, what is it that has you so jittery you want to speak in private?
Nephron asked. Sebek didn't answer. He closed the door behind them. Nephron folded his arms.
Oh, honestly, give it up. What's this all about?
It's Teklor.
Sebek spoke just above a whisper.
The kid. What about him?
Sebek proceeded to walk briskly around the shrine, opening the doors to the side rooms and looking inside. Nephron waited until he was done. Sebek had always been a little volatile, a little odd, but the truly talented always were a little crazy. Nephron had known Sebek for 1,000 years. He couldn't say they were friends, but then friends meant different things to different people. In all honesty, Nephron had never had what he would call a friend. Someone like him, someone he could relate to, someone who loved him and whom he could unequivocally trust. Sebek was more his opposite. Cold and detached, the Frey loved only his swords, and cared only that he was the best at killing. Sebek liked killing. He cared nothing for power, for advancement or wealth, just had a thing for fresh blood. Sebek wasn't an intellectual, not a thinker. Thoughts, other than those associated with combat, were a distraction, something to avoid. Sebek was as interesting as a dull rock, but he was a damn fine warrior.
Well, Nephron asked, taking a seat on the gold-framed, red-cushioned couch as Sebek walked back to him.
I think Teklor knows.
Knows what?
There was a knock on the door, and Sebek reached for his sword.
Who is it?
Nephron called out. Sebek's nervousness had him concerned. When the best warrior in the world was checking doors, whispering mysterious warnings, and reaching for metal at the slightest sound, only a fool would be relaxed.
Your humble servant, came the reply.
Nephron looked at Sebek.
Is Malcolm allowed in?
Sebek answered by opening the door.
Anyone see you come up?
Maybe, but who would care?
Malcolm walked in, still dressed in his absurd rune outfit of wool, despite the change in weather. He also wore a confused look similar to the one on Nephron's face.
What's going on?
Sebek checked the hall before closing the door.
I was hoping you knew,
Nephron admitted.
Sebek asked me up,
Malcolm said. Sebek closed the door again.
Teklor is from Dorea.
Malcolm glanced at Nephron with a smirk.
Yeah, we know. Is this news to you?
He was there.
Nephron leaned forward.
What do you mean by there?
Sebek walked away from the door, making the wooden floorboards creak with his weight. Alan Rist had likely made the same sound. Probably he made that noise when he walked to the stone moulding and set his wine cup down.
The kid was in one of the little villages we burned. He lived there.
Nephron shook his head. Not possible. We checked. No one survived those raids.
He pointed again at Sebek.
You were charged with making certain there were no witnesses.
Sebek stopped short of where the famous cup rested, gathering dust.
He must have been hiding.
He saw you,
Malcolm said, glancing back and forth between them.
He didn't see us,
Nephron said, willing it to be so. There were times he felt he was genuinely capable of such things. During battles, or in general, sheer determination and willpower were all that was needed. If he wanted anything bad enough, he could make it happen. This was often a warning sign of Miralith talent. As nothing could be more repugnant to him, he also willed that not to be so.
What makes you think he did?
Wraith and Tesh are the only surviving Duraeans,
Sebek said.
Wraith lived because he was in the wilderness with Malcolm, but Teklar was a kid. Why would a kid be away from home by himself?
That's all you've got.
And when I asked him where he was, how he avoided death, he didn't answer. He ran off and wouldn't even look at me.
Tesh would have said something by now, Nephron said. If he really was there, he would have seen us kill his family, his whole clan.
If that were true, do you really think he'd be training with you?
He wants revenge,
Malcolm said thoughtfully, as if thinking out loud. The skinny man sat down on one of the three fancy footstools.
When we first met him, Tesh asked to be called Freyhindir.
Sebek's eyes widened.
That explains the dedication. He's learning to kill us.
He walked the length of the room, then turned around and stared at Nephron.
I'm guessing he'll start with you.
This is all...
Nephron shook his head. Sebek wasn't as quick with his brain as with his swords.
Has he told anyone? Has he actually said he saw us?
No,
Sebek said. Nephron shifted his sight to Malcolm.
Don't look at me. I didn't even know about this until now. If he was going to tell anyone, it would be Wraith. They're both Duraean, and Wraith is his chieftain.
Did he tell him?
Malcolm shrugged. It's not like we're always together. They've had plenty of opportunities to chat without me around.
All the more reason to keep Wraith away from Persephone. If she were to hear of this...
Nephron made a peak with his hands and rested his face in them. His fingertips pressed the bridge of his nose.
Do you think she'd believe him?
Malcolm asked.
Things have come so far. You've built so much trust and credibility over the...
She's still a human, he snapped. They aren't rational.
Malcolm raised both eyebrows and tilted his head slightly to one side.
Excuse me?
You know what I mean. Besides, you're practically Frey.
Malcolm smirked.
I'll choose to interpret that as a compliment.
Even if he hasn't told anyone else, Teklar is still a threat,
Sebek insisted as he continued to pace.
That was another problem with Sebek.
He always needed to be moving.
Moving, fighting, killing. The phrase nightmare must be dying and being brought back to life by the gods as a still pond.
He's only 16 years old. 16! What will he be like in another 10 years? This kid is that good?
Sebek raised his brows.
How good were you at 16 years? Not 1600, not 50, 16. 15. Nephron hadn't touched a weapon of any kind at such a young age. Like most in Staria, his first century was considered childhood. His first decade was looked on as infancy, a time for unencumbered frivolity and discovery. It's not the same with them as with us. Doesn't change the fact that in 1 year the kid managed to master what takes most in Staria 100. I didn't call him Tech Lord to boost his confidence. Right now, he has enough skill to best most Erevan Frey, and he's just 16. Nephron dismissed the idea. In a practice bout, perhaps, but there's a big difference between training and the real thing. The kid will hesitate. He has no experience.
He's Duraean, Malcolm reminded them. Traditionally, they aren't a squeamish people.
Even so, it's not the same. Nephron stared at Sebek. Sebek shook his head. He's still a danger. If he's this good now, and remains dedicated to improving, what will he be like after fighting in a war? What will he be like in 10, 20, 50 years after he's gotten used to taking the lives of Frey? Old, Nephron said. More than likely dead. Don't forget he's still a rune. He learns fast. Too fast. He soaked up everything we can teach him. And the bow!
Sebek rolled his eyes and threw his hands up.
Moya tried to train us. Ares should be a natural, but compared to Tesh, they're bumbling fools. That kid can do anything.
Now he's asking for armor.
Iron armor. A lot of them are.
Sebek shook his head.
Don't you see? That's the last thing. When he gets that, Teklor will be ready. You nearly died fighting Wraith, do you? I did not.
Nephron scowled.
You should know better.
Sebek smiled.
I do. I fought him, just to be sure. But it's still nice to hear you say it.
Nephron glanced at Malcolm, who looked up at him from his perch on that stool with an almost whimsical expression.
Everyone had to believe a rune could beat a Frey in fair combat. Even the Galantians.
Well, guess what?
Sebek stared at him.
You don't need to pretend anymore. In 5 or 10 years, there's a good chance Teklor could beat you in a fair fight.
But something tells me Teklor isn't partial to fair fighting.
Sebek walked toward the cup and gestured at it.
You want to go back to your room one night and find a full-suited rune with 2 iron swords swinging at you from out of the shadows while you're squatting on your chamber pot? Maybe that's what they'll leave standing untouched in the middle of your shrine for people to visit.
Nephron looked at the cup on the ledge and nodded. He had too many plans to let it all fall apart because of some revenge-driven brat.
Disappointing. If what Sebek said was true, Tesh might have been the first rune Galantian.
Sounded like he'd fit right in.
Maybe that was the secret of the runes. They didn't last long, but while they lived, they burned brighter.
Kill him!
Nephron sighed and looked up at Sebek.
Make it look like an accident. Nothing embarrassing, either.
The kid deserves that much. I can't exactly hate him for wanting revenge against the people who killed his kin, now can I?
Sebek drew his sword and looked down at it as if the blade spoke to him.
I'll do it in a practice fight. I'll kill him and say Teklor caused me to slip. That he was that good.
Nephron nodded.
A fine epitaph. He'll be a legend after that. The rune that tripped up Sebek.
He deserves it. One day, he might actually have done it.
Chapter 13 Avam Partha. What Drumador is to the Derg, Avam Partha is to the Frey. To the rest of us, it was a terrible boulder in our path. The Book of Bryn.
Fenelaus once referred to the Tower of Avampartha as the Mill Wheel of Magic. Only Fenelaus could get away with calling the art magic, but then Fenelaus got away with a lot of things. She grew her hair long, forgave the Derg after a horrific war, and made a habit of crying late at night in the garden until she was escorted back to the palace. No one saw her drink anything stronger than apple juice, but Mandelay heard there were rumours. He'd barely known his grandmother. Mandelay saw the old Thane only during official gatherings. By the time he was born, she was too old to do much more than drool. She lived to the ridiculous age of 3,127. Some people thought she'd never die. First in that line had to be his father, who had waited forever to be Thane. Mandelay imagined his father had gone to bed at night and dreamed of smothering the old lady with a pillow. He hadn't. Instead, Lothian endured the passing of years in the shadows as the son of an icon that no one was eager to see die. Such a sentiment was understandable. The old Thane was the first ever Myrilith and the saviour of the Frey. Mandelay had never been a fan. He never liked anything old, and she was beyond ancient. The fact that Arion, the traitor, idolized Fenelaus only made him dislike the old Thane more. Nevertheless, he remembered having second thoughts the first time he saw Avampartha. The tower was widely considered the grand pinnacle of Myrilith achievement. Not a hammer or chisel had been used. Wielding the art, Fenelaus had managed what no builder could have. At the edge of the Partholorian Falls, and in the middle of the Nidwalden River, she had raised a tower. Stone had been stretched upward, imitating an explosion of water frozen at its apex. High above the thunderous cataract, the stone splintered, bursting in a bouquet of slender points that tapered to the size of a finger. This was a sculpture done in the scale of creation. Nothing Mandelay had ever seen compared to it. The tower was beyond beautiful. It was evidence of what the art could achieve with enough power, skill, and talent. Avampartha was as close to divine as the Frey had ever come. A temple to the art. Fenelaus had made it. It took her 3 days. The first time Mandelay laid eyes on Avampartha, all he could think about was that old wizened Thane who drooled on herself. How had she made this? Seeing it for a second time, Mandelay thought the same thing. Entering the tower was always a thrill. Fenelaus had made Avampartha to be an amplifier that conducted the insane power of the falls upward. Walking in, Mandelay experienced the rush. It literally staggered him. This drew odd looks from the non-Myrilith soldiers who trooped alongside. How can they not feel it? The year before, Grindel had spent the night in the tower speaking to him of how Myrilith weren't Frey, but new gods. Vibrating with raw power, he found the idea impossible to argue. Mandelay was convinced he could remake the whole world from inside those soaring walls. That visit, in the company of Grindel, had been wonderful, full of excitement and expectation. This time was different.
"You're not taking the child with you, are you?" Gerard asked, staring at Mandelay as if he were a stain on the floor.
"He asked to come, and I thought the experience might do him good," Lothian replied. "He might be Thane one day. He should know something."
As always, his father was overwhelming in the defense of his son.
It'd be better if you left him here with me. Let me teach the child something useful.
Wanderlei cringed at the very thought of being left with the old Kell. The steward of the tower was a month away from his own bout of uncontrolled drooling. He didn't even shave his head anymore, and had a wreath of white stubble growing around a natural bare spot. Wanderlei vowed that he'd kill himself before getting so old. There was a limit to what life should endure.
"He's been attending the Academy for the Art back in Estramnodon," Lothian said. "He's only done 2 seasons. I doubt he's acquired enough of the basics to even understand your lessons."
"The Academy." Jared said the word as if it were a bad joke. "They'll ruin him. All those instructors with their rules and lesson plans. They keep tight control, afraid of mistakes. You and I didn't learn that way. Your mother pushed us to make mistakes. Only way to learn. Remember?"
Lothian nodded.
"Perhaps on the way back."
The comment made the hairs on Wanderlei's arms rise. "Then I hope I die in battle."
Wanderlei could avoid being enslaved to Jared and the horrors of growing old in one act.
He imagined the moment as heroic, and thought the place of his death would be enshrined with the same reverence as the 2 boulders on the riverbank where Fenelaus stood to create Avanpartha.
Kel Jared, Fane Lothian, Wanderlei, Vasek, and Tarine were all seated in the Kel's personal study on the 2nd level. Sile and Sine did not sit. Probably wasn't a chair big enough for Sile. And Sine couldn't sit still.
Those seated shared a bottle of wine, but Wanderlei wasn't offered a glass. His father didn't appear to notice. Insulted at his exclusion, Wanderlei displayed his indignation by getting up and walking to the window.
Although he didn't expect anyone would see his action as a protest, he knew, and that was all that mattered.
Outside, the moon shimmered on the river below the Frey army as they marched across the Nidwalden on a bridge that ran from bank to bank. The span was temporary, ordered by the Thane, and created by Avanpartha Myrilleth. Once the army was across, the bridge would dissolve.
"I don't expect this war will take long," his father said. "We have nearly 2,000 soldiers and almost 50 Myrilleth. When we get there, erasing this insurrection and reclaiming Alanrist shouldn't take more than an afternoon. I won't bother to stay for the longer process of eradicating the runes. It could take months to get them all. I leave it to the new Lord of the Rist." He nodded toward Tarine.
Addressing Jared once more, he said,
"I should be back in a few days. You can have Wanderlei then."
"Wonderful. It'll be good for the lad to get out of that viper's nest you call Estramnodon,"
Jared said.
Then his voice grew a tad louder as he added, "I heard you got yourself in with a bad crowd there."
Bad crowd. In his mind, Wanderlei saw the fleeting image of Macaretta's face under a bridge, lit by magical light, the way he always remembered her. She was probably dead. He'd never found out, and the lack of knowing was difficult to take. The memory of her always hurt, and he wished it didn't. Macaretta had used him, tried to kill his father, did kill dozens of good people, and yet, in his mind, he still saw that beautiful face, and remembered how being with her felt. Her memory was frozen in flawless perfection, the highlight of his life, the only time his life had made sense. Realizing his future would likely be a sad legacy, he saw those days with her as a shining moment made brighter by the dark tragedy of its loss. He hadn't even had the chance to kiss her. Despite everything, He still fantasized what that might have been like.
No one said anything for several seconds, and Mwandalay realized Jared had been speaking to him when he made the comment. They were awaiting his reply. He turned back from the window to see everyone watching. He focused on Kel Jared. The old Frey looked far too satisfied.
Bad crowd? Perhaps. All I knew was that I was invited to a casual gathering by people considerate enough not to drink in front of me.
The Thane stiffened.
Mwandalay, show respect for the Kel.
Of course, Father. I shouldn't wish to insult such an accomplished Frey.
He continued to stare at Jared.
I heard you got yourself in with a bad crowd of giants. Oh, and congratulations on killing Arion. You did a superb job there.
Mwandalay! His father erupted.
Jared held up his hand to settle him.
It's fine. The child is wild. I'll fix that. Mwandalay, you might be a prince in the Talwara, but here you're an infant. If you want grape juice, make your own. You're Miraleth, aren't you?
The art doesn't create, Mwandalay said.
No.
Jared held out his hands, indicating the walls around them.
What's all this, then?
Fenelais drew up stone. She didn't make it.
Really? Touch the wall there. What kind of stone is that, do you think? Granite? Limestone?
I'm not an Elwyn. I don't know rocks.
What you don't know is vast, Jared said.
He snapped his fingers, and a goblet appeared on the windowsill. Rather than wine, it was filled with a stack of strawberries.
There, he said. Try one of those. They're perfect. With the real thing, you can never find them at their peak. Or if you do, they're always too big or too small, too tart or sweet. No, I must admit, I pride myself on creating a good strawberry.
Mwandalay stared at the cup of fruit, stunned. Even Grindel never created.
He was scared to touch any of the berries, but curious about how they would taste. Were they real? He reached out, plucked one off the top, and bit into it.
Perfect.
Across the room, the Kel of Avampatha smiled.
Still think I can't teach you anything?
I never said...
You didn't have to. Even without the art, you're an easy riddle to solve. You're the heir apparent to the Forest Throne, but you don't get the job unless you can win the challenge. If we held it right now, if your father dropped dead this very minute, and Amali gave me the Horn of Glendora to blow, who do you think would win? A child who whines about not being given a cup of wine, or an old Frey who can snap perfect strawberries into existence? If you want wine, if you want anything, Mwandalay, you make it yourself or go without. Don't rely on anyone but yourself.
Mwandalay was up early, standing on the south balcony. This was something Grindel had shown him when they were last there. The First Minister had roused Mwandalay from a deep sleep. The prince wasn't used to getting up before midday, and getting up before dawn was unconscionable, but Grindel had whispered for him to follow. The whisper had caught his attention. Whispers were for secrets. Maybe Grindel was going to share something personal, Mwandalay thought. And indeed he had.
That morning, just a year ago, Mwandalay had slipped out with Grindel to observe the sunrise over the Partholorian Falls. The light sent shafts across the brink, and through the spray, vivid, brilliant rainbows formed. Standing on the damp edge of the balcony, he stared in awe at a world that appeared more magical than he knew it was. The view this morning wasn't as grand as before.
Mandalay had wanted to recapture that moment when he and Grindel had stood side by side on that balcony and watched the glory of the world awaken, one of his best untainted memories. But what had once thrilled him now left him feeling dull, empty, and lonely. Grindel was dead. Even Avampartha felt smaller.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Mandalay spun to see Gerard in the archway. The ancient Frey wore a heavy cloak that he clutched to his wrinkled neck with bony hands.
What's he doing here? What's anyone doing here?
Fenelaus rightly assumed that people would want to look out into the falls, and as a result she'd created hundreds of balconies. Mandalay, like Grindel before him, had selected a remote one. Yet here was Gerard. The Kel smiled and shook his head.
Poor situational awareness.
What's that supposed to mean?
Mandalay pushed back against the short rail. He felt trapped. Before him, the nasty old man was grinning with malevolence. Behind him, the roar of the falls proved more frightening when he couldn't see it. Gerard, feeble as he was, appeared dangerous as he blocked the way back inside.
"He fell, my Fane. Sometimes people do that. And as we both know, your son wasn't the brightest star in the heavens."
"Yes. Mandalay has always been a disappointment. Let's not waste any more time on him. How about another cup of that marvellous wine, and maybe a strawberry?"
"Your mastery of the art has been stunted," Gerard said. "If you were one of my students, and you will be, you'd have known I was coming before I arrived."
"So you can tell the future, too."
"He's blocking the exit on purpose. I'd have to push him aside to get by. I'd have to touch him." Mandalay had no desire to be in the same world as Gerard.
He certainly wasn't going to touch him.
Mandalay slid his hands along the little wall of the balcony.
"Maybe I can climb down."
The stone was polished smooth, and even at that height still damp from the mist. He might as well have been leaning on ice.
"I can do many things. Grindel could, too. Did you know he could see what was happening hundreds of miles away? It's called clairvoyance. Even Fenelaus couldn't do that."
"Doesn't surprise me. Grindel was far better than—"
"Don't even think of finishing that thought."
Gerard stepped out onto the balcony with a raised hand. Mandalay remembered how Grindel had exploded the room with a snap of his fingers, and froze.
"Grindel had some promise, some talent, but he was consumed by his own arrogance. I gave up on him years ago."
"Gave up?"
"I taught him the art."
"You taught Grindel? My father said he went to the academy, said he learned from my brother."
Gerard smiled. "You'll find many teachers over the course of your life, Mandalay. So did Grindel. He did indeed attend the art school, but, just as with you, I offered to take over his instruction. Being smarter than you, he thanked me for the opportunity, and after I gave up on him, he found another mentor."
"Who?"
"The same one who taught Fenelaus."
Mandalay narrowed his eyes. "No one taught Fenelaus. She invented the art. My father said so. He's just boasting, trying to sound important."
Gerard shook his head. "You're too much like Grindel. I can see the imprint he placed on you, but I can't see why. He was using you for something.
But what?" "Grindel was my teacher."
The Kel laughed.
"Grindel had no interest in teaching anyone anything. He had one goal. Power. That's why he came to me for instruction. That's why he left me for what he believed to be a better teacher. Power
was always his goal. And somehow you were part of that path for him. I just can't see how.
He sighed.
Doesn't matter. The Frey is dead, consumed in the fires of his own arrogance, his plans gone with him. My task will be to fix you. Normally I wouldn't bother.
He waved at Wanderlei with a dismissive gesture.
Hardly any raw material to work with. But you are the prince, and that gives you a shot at the throne. Through no virtue other than your birth, you'll have a chance to be fane. I owe it to Faerol and our people to at least try and make a worthy Frey of you.
I'm not broken.
Ah, but you are. And in oh so many ways. Luckily, you have hundreds of years to make up for lost time.
And you're going to teach me?
Jared smiled. You think learning from me will be boring? A bunch of dull exercises, like those they drill into you at school, eh? What do you say we start our first lesson right now?
Wanderlei sensed a vague threat in that suggestion. First lesson? I'll throw you over that railing, and you can learn to fly. Sorry, my father says we're marching this morning. He's in a hurry to kill some people, and I get to watch.
Jared nodded, that smile stretching wider on his old, shriveled lips.
How would you like to do more than watch? Your father tells me you hated your old teacher. She stopped you from exacting justice after Grindel's death. You want to punish her for that, don't you?
She's a traitor. She should die. That's the law.
Yes, yes, the law, of course. But how would you like to be the one to enforce it? To be the one to execute her?
Wanderlei stared at the withered old man. The wind, wafting in updrafts, flapped his pale cloak and blew several strands of white hair against the grain. What are you saying?
You were right last night. I failed to kill her, as your father ordered. I won't make the same mistake twice, but I'm a little too old for extended travel.
He gestured up at the tower, rising behind them.
As you can feel, this is an extremely powerful source. From here, I can launch an attack on Alan Rist, if I wish.
That didn't work on Arion before.
No, it didn't. There are limitations. Avampatha allows me to see and hear and direct the art over vast distances, just not all at the same time. I was able to find her, then I had to disengage and swing blindly. Locating her was difficult after she knew what was happening. If I had someone on the ground, someone right there in the thick of it, who could send me updates and direct my attacks, combating Arion would be a simple matter. I just need someone I can work through. Someone like you.
How could I do that?
That's where the lesson comes in.
That awful teaching part. I don't have time to learn.
Just as Grindel knew how to see long distances, I know how to speak across leagues.
I can show you right now how to hear me, and then continue your education as you travel on toward Alan Rist.
By the time you arrive, you'll be able to help me target Arion. Through you, I'll be able to erase my mistake, and you'll have your revenge. Then, when you return, I'll show you other things the next Fane ought to know. Things that will make you invincible in the Carfane arena.
Wanderlei found himself nodding.
Beautiful sunrise, isn't it? Jared said.
Despite himself, Wanderlei couldn't disagree.
Chapter 14.
House of Bones. Strange how life often delivers the worst with the best, the highs with the lows, happiness with sorrow, and joy with screams that haunt a person forever, making it impossible to sleep in a room with a window. Then again, that might just be me. The Book of Bryn. Despite the beautiful spring afternoon, Bryn continued to glance nervously over her shoulder as she crossed the Corbel Bridge that connected the Verinthian to the Kype. Memories of that damp hand clamping over her mouth continued to send chills through her.
"Relax. Don't struggle."
Bryn had to tell someone. She would have gone to her mother if that had been possible. Hearing her say that everything would be fine while giving Bryn a tight hug was what she needed. Her mother was always good at that. But her mother was dead.
"I have you now."
Bryn banged on the door to the Kype, and the little window in the door slid back. "I need to see Persephone," Bryn said. The door opened. They knew her. She was the Keeper of Ways, and had the run of the place by order of the Koenig.
"She's up on the high floor,"
Ellison told her, jerking his thumb at the ceiling. The Frey closed and bolted the bronze door behind her, sealing out the sun. Bryn should have felt safer behind that heavily secured door. She didn't.
"Just need to get you back to the pyre."
"Bryn!" Persephone was all smiles when Bryn poked her head into the meeting room. The Koenig sat at one of the four tables filled with chieftains and Frey, each wearing serious faces. This wasn't a council meeting. They were held in the Verinthian. But Persephone looked just as frustrated. Before Bryn could say anything, the Koenig was up and walking toward her.
"I don't want to interrupt, I just..."
Persephone raised a hand, stopping her. Looking back at those in the room, the Koenig said,
"I'm sorry, you'll have to excuse me a moment. Lippitt, continue, and I'll be back in a few minutes."
With that, Persephone grabbed Bryn by the hand and hauled her into the corridor. She closed the door, threw her back against the wall, gritted her teeth, and began to bang her head against the stone.
"Seraph," Bryn said, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to—"
Again she held up a hand.
"It's not you. Trust me, I could kiss you for getting me out of there. I hate it when they bicker. The Gulod think I'm trying to enslave their clans through a dependence on Rulan food. The Rulan chieftains are terrified because I'm making them farm while the Gularoons train. Our people are convinced the Gula will turn on us. And every day there are more reports of incidents, insults, and conflicts between Frey and Runes."
Bryn smiled.
"I'm glad I missed it. Lately all your meetings have been the same. Not really worth writing about. Even the council meetings have been pretty repetitive."
Persephone took a deep, centering breath.
Wraith was right for turning down the job.
She pushed herself off the wall.
"Do you ever see him?"
"Wraith, I mean." Bryn looked puzzled.
"Isn't he in there right now?"
"No. This is primarily a discussion about clan grievances, and he doesn't have much of either. He doesn't even come to many of the council meetings anymore."
"But that's not what I meant. I was referring to a more informal setting, one not based on official matters. Do the two of you talk?"
"Sometimes."
"Does he seem all right?"
"I suppose."
"What's he been doing?"
"I don't know."
She shrugged. "Mostly I guess he's been teaching the young men in the courtyard. That's where I usually see him. He and Suri also go on a lot of walks. Neither one of them likes being in the city much."
"Why don't you ask him what he's been doing?"
"I was just curious." Persephone smiled. "Never mind. Did you want something? Or just come to save me from going crazy?"
Bryn hesitated, biting her lip. Persephone's eyes grew concerned.
"What is it?
What's wrong?"
"I think we have a row."
A row? Rafe asked. In Alan Rist?
Tesh nodded.
They stood between the great towers and the parapet, above the main gate, that afforded an unrivaled view of the Granford Bridge, and beyond it, the plateau of Dorea.
Tesh knew he'd find Wraith there.
The parapet was one of the few places to look at their home, without having to climb a few hundred steps to see over the walls. And he knew Wraith liked watching the sunset from there. Perhaps looking out at his old home had a way of reminding his chieftain of how far he'd come, which, when measured in physical distances, wasn't far at all. Wraith had his sword out, rubbing the blade with an oily rag. Roan had told everyone to do that once in a while, said otherwise the metal might go bad, like it was meat or something. Wraith was always oiling his. He took care of it like a woman with a newborn. Unlike the rest of them, Wraith's blade wasn't made by Roan or one of her army of workers. The sword he cleaned was dwarven, the one Persephone had brought back from Neith. Not only was it an excellent weapon, it possessed a remarkable legend. Many believed its markings were magical because the sword was reputed to have destroyed a mountain, made Persephone the Koenig, and slain a dragon.
"Rao don't live in cities, and certainly not fortresses," Wraith explained.
"Bryn is convinced it's a row," Tesh said. "She ought to know. She says she heard it one night, and I saw a clawed footprint near her house. Then another one when we were down in that maze of corridors and rooms under the Verenthian.
Wait. What? You and Bryn? What in Mara's name were you two doing down there?"
Tesh shifted uneasily. He wasn't trying to avoid the question so much as trying to find the right way to answer. He didn't want to admit it hadn't been his idea, that Bryn had led him down there. Wraith scowled.
"Tesh, the girl's only 14.
14? She is not. She's 16. Her birthday was months ago.
And what about you?"
"I'm 16 too."
Wraith rolled his eyes.
"I know how old you are, but where's your house? Where's your livestock, your crops, your furs, your fields, your traps? How are you going to take care of her? How are you going to take care of a child?"
"A child? That happens from kissing?"
Wraith smiled.
"Never mind. Now, what's all this about a row?"
Tesh watched as his chieftain carefully slid the magic blade into a scabbard that was decidedly less impressive.
"We think someone's hiding it, taking care of it.
Like a pet."
"I guess. No one keeps a row. Why would they?"
"Outside my window, I heard two people talking," Bryn said. "One was a man, the other a row. I'm sure of it now. I could tell by the voices."
She looked at Persephone until she was certain she understood.
This was another reason Bryn had wanted to talk to her. Persephone didn't need her to explain.
"I've been thinking about it. I remember that the man said something about an agreement they had."
"Agreement?"
Bryn nodded.
"I think the man was hiding it, feeding it somehow. He mentioned someone by the name of Jada. I think he might have lured Jada to the row."
Persephone was shaking her head.
"Why would anyone keep such a thing? How could they? Under the Verenthian are all these little rooms. I saw a footprint in one of them. A row footprint."
"It's called the Dujon,"
Persephone said. "A prison. I don't think there are any people down there anymore. But Nephron mentioned they used it for studying creatures."
"You shouldn't be going down there."
"Well, trust me, I won't anymore."
"But what if there had been a row there, and someone let it out?"
Persephone rested the back of her head against the wall, while her tongue slipped back and forth across the front of her teeth.
"Who would do such a thing? And why?"
"I don't know, but I think it was a rune."
How would a rune get access to a Rao from the Dorjon? It'd have to be a Frey. They are the only ones who know about that place and have access to it.
Bryn shook her head.
I found the Dorjon. Maybe someone else did, too. The night I heard voices under my window, they were speaking runic.
Nephron speaks runic.
A lot of Frey do.
But not when they are by themselves. And it's possible Rao only speak runic. The one that grabbed me did. It's just that he, the one talking to the Rao, didn't sound like a Frey. He sounded like a man.
Persephone frowned with a skeptical look. You're still having the nightmares, aren't you?
It's not that. I know this sounds like Bryn. It hasn't been that long. I still wake up covered in sweat, and I wasn't taken by that thing. It's real.
Okay. Let's say you're right. How would a rune learn about a Rao trapped under the Varenthian? And why would he be willing to hide it?
Do you remember that house in the city the first day we arrived? Wraith asked, making the switchback turn near the rain barrel as they headed down the stairs. The one Malcolm used to live in.
The one where he got in the fight with that fussy fellow? Tesh replied.
Wraith nodded and came around the third switchback.
The two were practically dancing down the staircase, but because of their worn boots, the only sound came from the slap of scabbards.
The two had left the parapet and begun walking back toward the open-air kitchen, which had been set up in the training yard.
No discussion, no comment. They both just started walking the moment they caught the smell of smoky roasting meat wafting from that outdoor spit.
Mealtime had a way of pulling people that way.
Yeah, Merrill said he was living there alone, but I saw someone in the upstairs window.
I think I remember you saying something about that, but I didn't see anyone.
Tesh's stomach rumbled. He was starving.
He went for hours working the rings, running the obstacle course, or sparring. Then he'd smell food and start salivating.
There was definitely a pair of eyes up there. Drew away the moment I spotted them.
What? Are you thinking that was the Rao?
Wraith shrugged. Why did Merrill say he lived alone?
Maybe it was a woman. Maybe a Frey woman.
I thought of that. But why would he hide such a thing?
Why would he care what we thought? In fact, didn't Malcolm mention something about him lying?
That's bothered me ever since.
Why would he lie?
By the time Bryn left Persephone, it was obvious the Keenig didn't believe her. Otherwise, Persephone would have done something. Instead, she insisted that Bryn stay and eat, proving by her lack of urgency that Persephone thought she'd only had a bad dream. As frustrating as it was to be ignored, Bryn conceded that she needed to eat. She was, in fact, starving. During the meal, Persephone made a point of asking numerous questions on random, unimportant subjects, none of which had anything to do with rows, dangers, or sleepless nights. They talked about how Rhone was killing herself at the forge, trying to create the perfect metal, how the dwarfs had become Rhone's devoted slaves. They also discussed a quilt Bedera was making with squares that depicted scenes from the last year, including one showing their fight with Balgargareth. The story squares had been Bryn's idea, but she thought it too arrogant to say so. And they also talked at length about the Book of Bryn. Bryn had 30 pages written that covered the origin of the gods, how Feral, Drome, and Mara had created the Frey, dwarves, and men, and how the evil one, called Uberlin, was born. And this somehow made the children of Erebus turn against their father and attack him. That whole area was murky. Some of the words were ambiguous enough to be confusing, and, at times, reading the older one's markings wasn't easy. This history of the gods was the first officially completed portion of the Book of Bryn,
aside from the metal formula that she did especially for Roan,